Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of SMIE Consulting's Midweek Roundup. Today, we'll be discussing three new issues in international education that have popped onto our news feeds in the last few days, and we'll be covering those in a little bit, but first I want to do some housekeeping. For those of you who have been listening on the podcast, thank you so much for taking the time to invest in a half hour of your week in listening to this my takes on these important issues. We hope that they're useful for you and hope that you find value in how they might be applied to your own institution. So what I'd like to do as a reminder to those of you who have been watching either here on Facebook or watching these on YouTube as well. We appreciate that time and certainly know that we hope to provide some value for you in the coming days and weeks with this half hour weekly chat, just to take a time to stop and see how what's happening around us can potentially impact what we do and how we might react appropriately or plan appropriately. So, in terms of where we are, we have had over the last few weeks, certainly in the last 2 years, we've had a lot of stories that have been popping onto our news feeds from particular political viewpoints on how the current administration's immigration stances and rhetoric surrounding immigration and what America First actually means have had an impact on what's going on in international education circles. And certainly one author that's paid quite a fair amount of attention to this topic, without laying blame completely on the current administration, and rightly so, a lot of the downturns that we're experiencing now in new student enrollments the last 2 to 3 years were certainly predictable and were coming with changes in scholarship programs and other factors that were impacting what we do in international education circles here in the U.S. But Karen Fisher from the Chronicle of Higher Ed has certainly spent a lot of time studying the impacts and the flows of international students coming to the United States, and she's done excellent pieces on Chinese students in different institutions, particularly in Big Ten institutions. She's also had an excellent piece recently on a lot of the impacts on of immigration policies and what we're doing. But here she now really takes kind of a big picture view, kind of goes back to something that's what we take for granted, obviously, in the recent past, with dramatic growth in U.S. International students coming to the U.S. and what that's meant for our institutions. And she's written a very in-depth piece this past week on how international education's golden age lost its sheen. And there are some who react to this piece quite negatively and say, yeah, we're really going down south fast, and we're losing our edge and all these other things. And to a certain extent, there's a bit of that, and a lot of that comes with complacency, frankly, in international education circles, where institutions were riding a salad train of Chinese students for a number of years, or other institutions, English language programs had largely been relying on Saudi and Brazilian students on scholarship that were coming for a number of years without future-proofing what they were doing in terms of diversifying the markets that they were using. There are English language programs that are closing up shop or cutting their beginning level programs because they just don't have the students anymore. So I'm interested to hear your feedback on this. One of the things that Karen Fisher uses in her article is a snapshot on a global emphasis on the decline. It's where she's looking at mission statements and strategic plans of institutions between 2006 and 2017 that represented, and this is from an AIEA study, that represented a change in how valued internationalization was in strategic plans and in mission statements of institutions. The high watermark apparently was in 2011, where 28% of institutional mission statements, according to AIEA, included placed a high priority on internationalization, whereas 60% of their strategic plans had a high priority on internationalization and spelled out different strategies to achieve that on campus. Those numbers from 28 for mission statement and 60% for strategic plans, that was the high watermark in 2011. In 2017, those numbers are down to 24% for high priority mission statement value on internationalization and 47% as a high priority on strategic plans for internationalization. So the landscape is clearly changing, and Philip Altbeck at Boston College, founding director of the Center for International Higher Education, certainly has been one of the prominent scholars that have spoken on a variety of the impacts on macro levels in higher ed when it comes to internationalization. So that drop off is fairly significant in terms of strategic planning. You see institutions moving away from prioritizing internationalization in their mission statements, particularly in their strategic plans. Never really got close to 30% as a high watermark for mission statements of institutions. I'd be interested to see, and maybe my colleagues in the UK and Australia might have data on a similar level for their institutions, and Canada especially, on how internationalization is prioritized in those countries. I'm sure that's part of the case that the article makes, that it's institutions, presidents in the U.S. tend to not have as high a priority on internationalization in terms of their using their weight to add value to these statements, other than perhaps in just paying lip service to what the value of international students are beyond money. You rarely hear that. But what I think is interesting is the significant drop off in how institutions in their strategic plans between 2006 and 2017, that 11-year period, having a 13% drop in institutions that valued internationalization highly as a value in their strategic plans. So, very useful article, and one that I have a lot of time for. Karen uses in the article is kind of looking back to in 2014, there were 140 students from 49 countries graduating from NYU's Abu Dhabi campus. And that's kind of walking through that process and how other universities, American universities, started opening campuses abroad, Yale in Singapore, Duke in China, others as well. Those are really the exceptions rather than a rule. We've talked about this on as it relates to UK higher ed and how their what they call transnational education, or in this case, it's where they have campuses, physical campuses in other countries like in NYU Abu Dhabi. But for British institutions, British higher ed, they actually have more students earning British credentials, degrees outside the UK than they do inside, because British universities years ago strategically planned to build locations around the world and to use their education system, one of their greatest assets for the British economy. They use that and exported that. Their facilities abroad, as well as having their home bases in the UK. So US really hasn't embraced that to the extent that British Australian institutions have. I'd be interested to see what those numbers look like, but certainly that has been kind of a way that a lot of UK higher ed institutions have been able to future-proof their campuses in terms of expanding their grip and their influence in international higher ed to a much greater extent than just the few institutions, the dozen or so, that maybe two dozen of U.S. institutions that have opened up campuses abroad in the last decade. So the article is well worth a read, and I've certainly included that in the comments section on the Facebook page, so I encourage you to check back in to read that at your leisure. But there's always going to be value in taking that kind of bigger picture pause every so often, and we certainly try and do that here at SMIE Consulting, and really help to give some perspective on things and add some value where possible to what you do. The second article is another one that probably more directly lays the blame of the current downturns in international students coming to the U.S. To Trump's immigration policies and how it's hurting American businesses. And this is from the perspective of a son of refugees. His parents are Palestinians that were refugees from Palestine and landed in Saudi Arabia. They then made their way to the United States. The son of these refugee parents has gone on to become create a couple of startups, raising millions of dollars to invest, and in more than 40 companies. He's a kind of a venture capitalist, if you will. His point is from the perspective of immigrant parents who came to the U.S. and made a better life. Certainly, he's made a better life for himself as a result, as the first generation in the U.S. But he says that his main tag is the grit and determination of newcomers has driven American ingenuity over the course of its history. And certainly there's no doubting that we are a nation of immigrants. We are a great melting pot, even though those terms don't seem to be used much anymore in this country. We are a country that values the skills that people bring to this country. From outside that come here for the hope and the opportunity and the quote-unquote American dream. So what I see really is, with this article, it makes the case that immigrants are really the foundation of American business, successful businesses these days. Of the Fortune 500 companies, 44% were started by immigrants or the children of immigrants. There is just great value in this author's eyes. On what that drive of those that are coming to the U.S. seeking a better life. This young man, or not young anymore, but he grew up in Jeddah before his parents moved the family to the United States. And he grew up in Saudi Arabia, but he said he didn't feel like that was home when they were in Saudi Arabia. He said it was from reading about America in magazines and books, watching American movies, listening to American music, and learning about the American dream that allowed me to imagine a new home in the States. And that's where anything was possible, he thought. And he applied to American colleges, studied near outside of D.C., and then went to Washington State, and there was great opportunity for him. And he says, this is the phrase that really, really gets me and kind of cuts to the heart of who we are as international educators and why until we realize this and stop taking for granted the successes we've had and have to work harder and smarter, this is the crux of where we are at this point. And this is his perspective. Today it's different. International students don't need to study in the United States to realize their full potential. Certainly not when the president smears immigrants with a broad brush and scares them with public charge rules and citizenship questions on the census. Now, when he continues to signal to the world that we're no longer the place for the tired, poor, or huddled masses yearning to be free. And certainly not while he's willing to kick out dreamers who know no other home and deport temporary protected status visa holders who have fled violence and persecution. And this is his line. If I had heard that message when I was applying to colleges, I might not have come to America to study. I might not have launched a company from my dorm room that forever changed my life and endeared me to the promise this country has to offer. And I think those are the messages that we need to take on board more fully as international educators, and realize the situation that, yes, the current administration's policies, the rhetoric towards immigrants has been largely dismissive of their value to the United States. And that's something we have to battle against. We have to battle against it knowing that, hey, over half the country well, not population-wise, but certainly in the Electoral College, over half the country voted for this man who has these views, and how these policies are now being implemented is a reflection of those who voted for him. And certainly we need to understand that and appreciate that from the perspective where those folks have come from, that make the decision, seeing their jobs under threat, seeing, hearing the politics of immigration being used as in negative connotations when for decades this country, built on immigrants, is really that past is largely forgotten. And it's our responsibility, frankly, to remind our elected leaders, remind our friends and family, remind those who we disagree with that, hey, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for immigration policies that allowed my father to come and work in the U.S. back in the early 70s. That's something that I think is important to emphasize at all points in our discussions, from conversations with elected leaders to our friends who might disagree with us, but emphasizing the value of these different perspectives have had on forming this country. And something I think we all need to understand more in what we do on a day-to-day basis as international educators, and something that I wish more of the country, frankly, could see. And Karen's article about the sheen being off our international ed golden age here in the States, certainly there's a real truth to what she's saying. But has the landscape shifted? Certainly. Is it going to shift again? Yes, absolutely it will. Is there a pendulum swinging back the other way? Yes, there certainly can be. But what's going to drive that are institutions that really understand what it means to be in international education and what it means to commit to it. Rather than just see the dollar signs, they see the opportunities to expand their influence as an institution, with the students that they educate, with the partnerships that they build, with the faculty that they bring to their campus from outside the United States. Those perspectives and institutions that see that long game and see the value in what we're really trying to do here with international education, those are the ones that can help drive us to a more comprehensive and pro-immigration, pro-international education environment that we can operate in. Certainly, there are groups that, like NAFSA's advocacy days that happened a couple weeks ago. Those are important parts of what all of us should be doing as international educators, not just those that are NAFSA members or those that choose to go to Capitol Hill, those that choose to email their legislatures. Those are the folks that will make the difference. And being involved in this today is kind of their blitz week this week is blitz week for NAFSA in just making sure to keep front and center in our legislators' eyes, in our colleagues' eyes, in the general public's eyes, frankly, raising the profile of international educators, that international education of bringing international students in by sending our students abroad is really what adds value to our country and helps us become great and continue to be great. And this is something that I think we all need to embrace as international educators, but certainly from the son of an immigrant, son of refugees coming to the United States and being as successful as he has been, that's a perspective that is very, very insightful for us. And that the line he uses, what international students do not need to come and study in the United States anymore, necessarily. We want them to, absolutely want them to, that they don't need to. They have options. And that's probably the thing I make abundantly clear in every conversation I have with university folks that are considering what to do on international student recruitment and international education issues is, are you going to invest in this? Are you committed to this? Because if you're not, step out of the way, because there are plenty of other countries, there are plenty of other institutions in those other countries that will be more than happy to take those students that might have wanted to come to the United States in the past that no longer do because they don't feel welcomed. So a lot of folks have written on this topic. I've written on it. I'm going to be writing on it again for my colleagues at U.S. News Global Education. I allude to all of this in my work with IDP Connect. And it's just something I feel very much in my core that we need to be doing more to convince the powers that be of the value of what we do. And if we don't want to do it, get out of the way because there are plenty of others who will. Plenty of others in the United States that are getting their acts together and can see the value in what we're trying to do here and the value of not letting these negative perspectives on what international means in the United States dominate the conversation and not letting xenophobia kind of rule the day. And this is something that certainly we need to be sensitive to, and certainly one that we need to be ever vigilant on in our conversations and what we do and say with our colleagues. Now, one institution or one destination that certainly in the past has had their own challenges with xenophobia, with bad press and such, is Australia. They had certainly had a down period mid-noughties and had in the early teens, and really have rebounded quite well. And we know in Australia, it's a country of less than 40 higher education colleges and universities. But in those institutions, in their vocational education programs, which they're particularly strong in, they have hundreds of thousands of international students coming to their shores to study. Just posted the link to this latest article from ICEF Monitor. They do some great work there at ICEF Monitor on these kind of national overviews of countries, and particular in Australia, they've done a lot of good work there in kind of documenting what's going on and trends there. There are now in Australia, I think the latest numbers are almost 700,000 international students in the country. Now, those numbers include... that was just in 2017. Total international enrollments also grew substantially to reach 876,400. Discrepancy between the both is, between those is, you could have some students in two different categories. For Australia, their three largest subsets of international students are in higher education, so degree-seeking undergraduate or postgraduates, vocational, and then English language. Those two, higher ed is somewhere in the 160 to 170 range, about 160 range. In 2018, vocational education is right around just under 150,000. English language is around 105,000 or so. So we see a lot of those numbers. They've been going up. Where there's been the biggest jumps is in higher education and vocational education in the last year, where Australia has seen the most significant growth. It's been double digit for Australia in the last couple of years, and that means they are reaping the benefits. You might ask, where is Australia really seeing the greatest success? Certainly China, as it is in the United States, has a very significant footprint. With over 255,000 Chinese students enrolled at Australian institutions, this is it's a 30% market share roughly. They account for just over a third of the increase in total numbers of students. Where you see the greatest, the three countries that have had the greatest percentage increases have been Nepal, which has increased to 52,000 students. India, which is at 24,000 students, and then Colombia, which is up to 108,000 in India, and Colombia up to 26,000. So those three countries have all seen enormous growth, and then Brazil as well as the other double-digit increase for that country. And Brazil is now over 40,000 Brazilians are studying in Australia. They represent now the fourth largest group of international students in Australian institutions. So we see a lot of growth from parts of the world. South America, 10, 15 years ago, was barely registering on Australia's radar. But their institutions have invested heavily through tours, through outreach, through foreign language translations of their materials. They've done a number of things to make themselves much more attractive to Brazilian market. So you're seeing penetration in Latin America, not only in Brazil, but also in Colombia. So kudos to the Australians. They're doing it right. But we also are getting into the situation again where institutions, less than 40 colleges and universities, the average percent international at those institutions is anywhere between 20 and 30%, some as high as 50%. So those are dangerous numbers that are leading to potentially some blowback from international, maybe less internationally friendly institutions in that country. So interesting to see what happens there. That might be driving some of the some of what goes on in the coming weeks and months for overseas institutions. Now, one thing I do want to remind everybody of for those that are following me on social media through Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, even Instagram now. Certainly, thank you for that, and we want to make sure that you're aware of the resources that we have for you as international educators, and we always reference our website, so smieconsulting.org. Some great free resources there, blogs that I've written, articles that might be of particular value to you, some excellent presentations I've been involved in over the last decade or so that have some long-term value, I think, as well as complete detailing of some of the services that we provide for institutions, whether it's long-term data planning and strategic data-driven decision-making to social media marketing, long-term strategic planning on the social media side or the institutional side for international ed. So that's, I just want to make you aware of that as you go through your days, and certainly don't want to leave this chat without mentioning certainly the website and the podcast. Those that have subscribed to our SMIE Consulting e-news, that's always where we draw these particular stories each week, and certainly encourage you to do so as well. Put the link to this week's edition of all the SMIE news fit to share. You'll see each of those links there are drawn that we talk about on this chat each week come from that newsletter that comes out Mondays at 9 a.m. So looking forward to having you take a look at that newsletter. Also check out the resources on the website, and we obviously look forward to talking to you again in the coming weeks and months. For those of my Ohio colleagues, I'll see you on Friday at the Ohio State Drive-In down at Columbus State. Looking forward to connecting with each of you and seeing where there might be chances to work together for a better international education future for your institutions. So thanks very much for joining me, and hope to hear from you soon. Cheers.